Hey, again, I'd like to thank you, the organizer of this meeting, and it's really a pleasure to be here. I think this is a very nice conference. Okay, today I'd like to talk about our recent purely observational work of the in-situ open ocean surface wave field. And what we wanted to try is to try to kind of make some kind of quantitative analysis to capture the nonlinearity or the steepness and possibly the short-crestedness of the wave, and which of course we cannot easily do with traditional spectral analysis. And so this is mainly done by my two of my former students, and also I'd like to acknowledge Ed Walsh and Paul Wan, who provided the spatial surface wave measurements. Okay, so the outline of the talk is the following. I'd like to kind of talk about two somewhat different studies, and mainly because we have two very different kind of data sets. And the first one is based on the data analysis based on the surface elevation, a wave elevation measurement at three wave gauge in a triangular configuration. So we have the long time series of the wave height at 3 points. And then the other one, which we obtained from Paul and Ed, was actually one of the data sets is actually the same as what Paul showed. This is the scanning altimeter system, which gives you the two-dimensional snapshot of the surface topography. But there's no time dependence. It's kind of snapshot. So one gives basically the spatial information with no time evolution, whereas the other one gives the nice time evolution, but spatially just a 3 point. So basically what we did is somewhat very different data analysis. But I'm hoping, well, at least from my point of view, I think there are some kind of tentative, I can't maybe say conclusions, but at least suggestions, is that real ocean surface waves tend to be quite steep or even breaking. And actually we know they're breaking. And also it seems like they are quite short crested. And also this is probably the most controversial, but seems like if you focus on the very steep wave front, they seem to be more well aligned with wind. But if you take the spectrum, the traditional spectrum, either in the wave number or frequency, then first of all, I'm pretty sure that those can be quite strongly influenced by the bound harmonics of the short crested waves, steep waves. And also those bound harmonics can be quite directional if the these large steep waves are very short crested, then obviously if you take the Fourier transform, the higher harmonics have all different directions. So that might be one of the reasons why if you look at the pure statistical directional spectrum, they might have wide directional spreading. And the question, of course, is whether you actually have freely propagating waves in the different directions, or some of them might be actually come from this higher harmonics. So those are the things which our analysis will suggest. But unfortunately, we can't really prove anything because the field data has a lot of limitations. Okay. So first of all, I want to basically point out that most of the time, surface waves are characterized by the traditional spectrum, either frequency or wave number. And I'm in oceanography, and our interest is not so much for the wave dynamics, but more in terms of how the surface waves will impact the flux of the energy or momentum or gas between ocean and atmosphere. And for that kind of applications, waves are just one of the small parts of the input. And therefore, in practice, we usually put at most the wave spectrum, or sometimes just the significant wave height. Those are the things which we usually worry about. But of course, when we start talking about the details of the role of different waves of different scales, particularly for AST gas flux, we worry about small scale waves. And then, of course, we want to make sure that what we are putting as an input is the right information. But of course, a lot of the processes going on is rather highly nonlinear, and a good example, of course, is wave breaking, which affects the AST flux tremendously. But the wave spectrum usually do not contain information about nonlinearity or the breaking waves. We might be able to have some kind of indirect estimates from spectrum, but certainly the wave spectrum alone does not give you all the information. And also, one thing I started to worry about is when we simply use the frequency spectrum as the wave field, which is basically assuming that we have this bunch of sinusoidal small amplitude wave field at different frequencies, then frequency spectrum gives you the information about all different wave scales. But if the observation of the frequency spectrum turns out to be mainly determined by the harmonics from the dominant waves, then the frequency spectrum has no information in terms of small wave. All you get is basically the dominant wave and its steepness. And this is something we have to be aware of, and I'd like to show some evidence first that indeed this might be the case. So the first thing is basically using this time series measurement at 3-point wave gauge. And the motivation is that we already knew from the lab experiment that when we have a very well-developed narrow dominant peak, then if you simply calculate the frequency spectrum, then indeed the high frequency part of the spectrum is completely dominated by the harmonics. So indeed, what's happening in a small scale does not affect the frequency spectrum, which has been known already in 1979 by Mitsuyasu. But at the same time, those authors as well as everyone else assumed that in open ocean, that's not really the case, because usually the peak region of the spectrum is not as narrow or well-developed, and therefore, relatively speaking, the bound harmonics is not as pronounced. However, recently, there's a theoretical work by Belcher and Basilikos, and their theory is very extreme. They assume that all the waves are breaking. So they basically saturated the surface with all breaking wave crests, and then they calculated the spectrum resulting from that configuration, and they show that in this case, the frequency spectrum is basically determined purely by the biggest breaking waves and the harmonics, and there's nothing else coming into this spectrum. So we thought that if theoretically this is possible, then observationally that might be actually possible too. Let's see. Okay. So what we did is we used this observation made from the 3-point wave measurement made from the SLEP, which I show you next, off California coast. And the wave field was chosen over 3 days, basically when the wind was weak first and then picked up to 30 meters per second and persisted long time. So by the end, we had pretty well developed seas. And also there was no fetch limitations, just the time dependent problem. And we calculated traditional wave frequency spectrum. We also calculated slope spectrum because we had 3 wave gauges, so we could fit the slope and then calculate the slope spectrum. And then we finally did the bicoherence, bispectrum analysis. And that gives at least some information about the possible phase coupling between the dominant and higher harmonics. Okay. So this is the flap, and basically, this can sit anywhere in the middle of the ocean, and this is particularly a great platform to obtain the pure open ocean condition with no effect from the coast. And in this experiment, the data set, the wind was coming from offshore, so there was no question it was not affected by the coastline. So this is the 3-wave spectrum I chose, and starting at the low wind, we have kind of very weak wind sea and fairly well developed swell coming from offshore.
Slope.
What's
the degree of
dashed line? This is, let me think. I think I put F minus 4 and 5. So this is 5, and then this dotted line is 4. Okay. So, okay, then when the wind started and wind pick up, we see this wind sea development, and then there's this wind sea peak as well as swell peak. Dashed line is 5. And this dotted line near the peak is 4. And again, this is the final stage where the wind is well, almost fully developed. So we have this wind sea here, and swell is kind of hidden here. And the spectrum is somewhat F minus 4 near the peak, but most of the region F to the minus 5, which I think is quite consistent with a lot of other observations. Okay. And also I want you to notice that this higher frequency part, okay, the level of this part increased by order 10 from the beginning to the end. So even the higher frequency part increased significantly. I did again. Okay, sorry. Now, this is the slope spectrum, and I also wanted to point out this is a linear scaling frequency now. And again, at the beginning, when the waves are kind of not developed yet, we had basically what I want you to focus on is the slope in the direction of the wind and perpendicular component, which is the dashed and dashed dot. And here, those two components are almost comparable, so which means the waves are pretty much widespread. But when the wind shear starts to develop, near the peak of the wind shear, you actually have a very clear separation. The most of the slope is in the wind direction and a very small slope in the crosswind. But if you go away from the peak, like 2 to 3 times the peak frequency, then the slope, again, becomes kind of omnidirectional. So the wave seems to be going all directions. Okay. So that's one thing we can see from here. Now, then what we did also is to do the bicoherence elevation time series analysis. And basically, the bispectrum is the extension of the regular spectrum. We try, well, basically, you capture the phase duration between the frequency omega 1 and omega 2 and the resulting omega 1 plus omega 2. And if the waves at omega 1 and omega 2 is totally phase uncorrelated, then this ensemble average should be zero because you have all the phase duration. But if they are always phase coupled with particular phase shift, then this one has some finite magnitude. So if you normalize this based on this maximum, then this bicoherence basically tells you how much the signal between omega 1 and omega 2 are correlated. If B is 1, it's fully correlated, and if B equals 0, it's totally uncorrelated. So that's a kind of nice indication, at least to find out the possible phase coupling. And this is the result we can't obtain from the three time series. And since bispectral analysis is a higher order spectral analysis, it's very difficult to obtain the statistically significant numbers. You need a lot of degree of freedom. So with these data sets, the only thing we could do was to find the bicoherence exceeding 0.13, and if that happens, 95% we can say that the bicoherence is not zero. So there is a correlation. That's all we can say. Okay. And so we can't really trust the number very accurately, but at least we can say when there is a bicoherence above 0.13, there's a very likely possibility that the phases are somewhat coupled. And at the first weak wind shear, of course, there's nothing. But as the wind wave develops, you start to find this finite bicoherence, mainly between the dominant harmonics and higher harmonics, which is like 3 to 4 times the dominant frequencies. And that gets stronger as the wave develops. And this bicoherence might be as big as 0.2. So that means that 20% of the signal is actually phase coupled. So this kind of suggests, at least, that indeed, for very strongly forced wind wave seeds, the high frequency part of the signal actually might be at least partially coupled with dominant waves, which is most likely due to the fact that they are bound harmonics. But one of the things which you have to remember is that the range where we actually start to see the phase coupling is also the range where the slope spectrum becomes almost comparable between along wind and crosswind. So that means that those waves are not going into the wind direction, but actually going in different directions. Otherwise, slope spectrum should not be that similar. So the only possibility or the plausible explanation is that the slope spectrum, this high frequency component, which seems to be phase coupled, is not generated by this long crested big wave, which will just generate the higher harmonics, which also generate, propagate in the same direction. But instead, if those dominant waves are short crested, then the higher harmonics can be going into different directions. And I think like crescent patterns, for example, obviously generate the higher bound harmonics in different directions. So again, this is not the evidence or anything conclusion we can't prove that this is the case, but at least data suggests the possibility. And in part two, what I'd like to show is now the data analysis we did with the spatial measurement. And well, the motivation, again, is by far the most important motivation is the fact that we actually now have technology to actually obtain the snapshot of the ocean surface. using the scanning altimeter system. And we saw that, and of course, the poll has shown very nice results of the spectral analysis. But what we wanted to do is do something a little bit more different from traditional spectral analysis. And the reason is because basically, ultimately, what we want to do is to identify breaking waves. And of course, Ken Melville has done a very nice work of observing white caps. And he could differentiate the white caps coming from different wave scales. And one of the points he made was that the breaking is happening in all different scales. And all scales are important depending on application. So you kind of have to look at the waves of the wide range of scales and find out how the breaking is taking place. And therefore, they use this breaking wave statistics lambda function, which is basically the statistics of wave breaking crest distribution as a function of the speed of the propagation speed. But of course, those measurements are done something like using the white caps or the radar backscatter measurements. But what we want to do is see whether there's any relation between this breaking wave statistics and some kind of spatial topography information. And the other thing which also motivated our work is that there have been a series of studies which show that if you start with the moderated wave packet with decently large steepness, then the moderation of the packet might lead to the breaking. And that seems to be quite robust. And so it seems like if you can detect the event of this fairly steep packet of the wave, then that might be a good indication of relating this number of events like of the groups to the number of events like breaking statistics. So on one hand, we want to identify the very extreme events of very high slope, high wave, height events, but at the same time, we want to identify the scale of the wave, not just the dominant scale, but all the scales. So from those two conflicting requirements, we saw that the best compromise might be to perform the wavelet analysis to the wave height topography. And that way, we can capture the events of this group of waves happening here and there, and we can actually count the number of events. So these are the two data sets we use. This is from Ed Walsh. This is obtained, actually, Mike Banner was, of course, one of the organizers of this experiment. And this was the scanning radar system, which resolution is poor, but they can see a much, much wider range. And this was done with very, very strong wind of 26 meters per second. So the swell was a few hundred meter scale. So it's a very large scale wave. Whereas this is the data which Paul obtained, and he actually did the analysis of the spectral calculations. That's the same data. And this one is a lower wind, and the wave is almost one-tenth length. And please neglect those white kind of lines. But if you look at the topography, this white region is the crest, and the black is trough. You can kind of identify this wave. But if you focus on the very, very high crest peaks, then, of course, those are not really a line, but it's more like a dot. So clearly, particularly in the higher slope limits, the waves don't look like a kind of long-crested structure, but more like short-crested structures. And also, it's not obvious to me by just looking at this picture how this generates this bidirectional distribution in higher wave numbers, although if you do the Fourier analysis of this, you do get bidirectional analysis because this is a data set. And we actually did confirm. This data also generates bidirectional spreading at the higher wave numbers. But it's not very obvious to me from this topography itself. And one thing we decided to do is to apply the wavelet analysis. And one of the assumptions, which is kind of the weak point, but we basically made the slice of this topography along the mean wind directions first, and then what we did, then we basically applied a wavelet transform, which is basically the convolution between the real signal and this particular wave shape. In this case, we chose the Moret wavelet with k equal 5, because we are looking for the kind of wave packet which is not too long, and also the shape is basically wave-like. And what we do is we calculate the convolution of this wavelet with different a different length scale. Basically, you scale this to search for the wave packet of different scales. So this is an example of the wave elevation time spatial series along the wind direction. And this is the wavelet transform result. And this is the function of the wave number, which is the scale of the wave, and this is the spatial. Okay. And what you see, first of all, is that wavelet transform goes negative and positive. And basically, when you slide this wavelet, and when they hit the crest with crest, they get the positive maximum. And when they're out of phase, they get big negative. So for lower K, where the wavelength is longer, you have this positive, negative, positive. That's the kind of the wavelengths you're looking at. And then for high K, you have positive, negative, positive very in a narrow distances, of course. But one thing you notice is that if you look at this wavelet transform, and by the way, we scale this such that the height of this transform is proportional to the slope of the wave of that scale. So if you focus on this distribution, you find that there's a kind of local maximum in K and space domain. And the reason is because this maximum means that you are doing the best fit in terms of fitting the wave number here. And the location, this is the best location where when you slide physically, you do the best fit in this location. So you basically find that this peak represents some kind of the when the, you hit the real right position and length scale, you get this maximum. So we decided to define every time we find this local maximum, that is one event, which is the one event of the best fit. And if you look at, particularly in this large scale, if you find these three, these correspond to this peak, and this one, actually, the wavelets think this is like a one big wave, so there's a middle here. And also, for smaller waves, you also identify many, many peaks corresponding to those stars. And if you apply this for all straight line and then do assemble this, then these are the results of identified this best match, which is basically the best fit location of the crest at the middle of this wave packet. And we can do that at different thresholds. Like if you capture all the events with wave slope less, larger than 0.02, you get this result. If you raise the criteria, you get much less events, and those are the events you identify. And we are quite encouraged that, although we are looking at some kind of compromise approach, nevertheless, we might be able to identify the events of crest pretty well. And not only that, once we find the spatial distribution, we can connect those events horizontally as long as they are next to each other. And then we can actually identify the horizontal length of those crest events. And of course, sometimes they are not quite straight. But you see that our observation and our analysis gives mostly the crest line, which is kind of perpendicular to the wind direction. Now, before going to the result of this, let me just show you the data sets we use. There are four data sets from the Southern Ocean, where in all cases, the wave scale is very large, a few hundred meters. And then in the DNC, which Paul Wang provided, the wave scale is 1/10. And we had four very different wind conditions from Southern Ocean. And we defined the steep wave statistics, which is basically analogous to the breaking wave statistics, such that this lambda t k over theta is the total length of the steep wave front, which I just showed you as a line, with wave slope exceeding a particular set threshold t per unit wave numbers. And we can integrate in all different directions, and we can also sum up everything, and that gives you the total crest length. Okay. So this is basically the same as the breaking wave statistics. Now, if you calculate this function, now this is the one from the very high wind, SOEX, and this is lower wind. And you can actually start with very, very small wave slope, where we have a lot of identified waves, and you start with many, many waves. And at the very low wind, you seem to have about the same number of events, regardless of the wind. But when you increase the wind, suddenly the higher slope event is much more common in high wind, but they don't exist in a lower wind, so they stratify. I also want to point out that the number of those events seems to have distribution widely in the K. So those events don't just happen near the peak, but they actually happen in all different scales. This steepness is basically the best fit to the wavelet, this wave packet, and I'm looking at this the wave slope at the middle. Right. So this is like a number of events you find where the middle of the wave actually has the slope of 0.16. Okay. Yes. Okay. And I also...
How can the stateless be independent of the wind speed?
You mean if you look at the very, very, very low threshold,
yeah,
then basically you're counting all the way regardless of the slope, right? Right. Then one thing we found is that this threshold seems to decay very nicely with this form, which is basically exponential to the minus power times the t squared, where the t is the wave slope. And it turns out that this statistics is consistent with the estimate done by Longest Higgins for the narrow-banded system, where he could predict that this function should actually decay like this. But we applied for the wide-band spectrum, and nevertheless, this seems to work. And another thing we found is that if you kind of extend this to the known value of the breaking statistics from Ken Melville's and the setup study, then that suggests that the threshold of about 0.12 seems to be about the comparable to the breaking wave statistics. In other words, the number of the steep wave events at threshold 0.12 is about the same as the number of the breaking waves. And I just want to make two comments. One is that this directional spreading of this steep front is very narrow-banded, mostly plus minus 10 degrees, which is totally different from the directional analysis of the spectrum, which has bimodality. And also, if you look at the length of the crest relative to the wavelength, you find that most of the waves are much shorter, the crest length is much shorter than their wavelength, so which means they're very much short-crested. So what I find is that, first of all, steep wave crests seem to exist over an entire wave number range, and at lower thresholds, there are basically the same number of waves, but if you increase the threshold, you have many more wave events at higher wind, and it seems like 0.12 seems to be about the threshold of the breaking if you just simply compare the numbers. And I also want to make sure if you use different wavelets, you still get the same qualitative results. And those steep waves tend to be very short crested and also most propagate in the wind direction. So one of the possibilities, which again is my speculation, is that if these steep waves are very short crested but going to the wind direction, then if you look at the wave numbers Fourier spectrum, then the bound harmonics can be quite directional because they are so short crested. So at least partially, the reason why we have strong directional spreading might be because the very steep dominant waves are so short crested and they might generate a lot of directional bound harmonics. So that's kind of the common conclusion from those two studies. Thank you.